Education Committee to order for Monday, February 27th, 2012. I think we're close to a quorum, but maybe we might not have it at. I think you just did it, Senator Harrington.
I've been here for a while.
Yes, I know you're. I can't. So we do. There, a quorum is present. We will begin with Senate File 1917 with Senator Wolf, who is having a busy day today. This is the bill on the prone restraint.
Yes, thank you, Madam
usage.
Chair.
Yes.
Actually, there is an
Senator
author's
Wolf.
Amendment. If we want
I
to
believe that's been distributed to us. It's the A1 amendment. That's an author's amendment.
Correct.
So Senator Wolf moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 1917. All in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Senator Wolf.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, I think I am going to turn the mic over, and you can. Do you want to explain the author's amendment as well as the amendment? I mean, as well as the bill?
Certainly.
Ms. Dozlin?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Dozlin, and I represent the intermediate school districts. Very briefly, what House File 2293 does, and I'll also touch on the author's amendment, it extends by 1 year to August 1st, 2013, the authority for school districts to use prone restraints under current requirements and statute. And it also adds some new provisions. One, it clarifies that districts must use a form provided by MDE. It requires that MDE report back to the chairs of the education committees by February 1st, 2013 on the use of prone restraints. It also requires MDE to publish the data in an accessible format on the department website quarterly. It clarifies the definition of, the author's amendment clarifies the definition of prone restraint and just adds some definitions of prone restraint, which were part of the report that the Department of Education provided to the committee in February, as well as it clarifies that a child must be at least 5 years old in order for prone restraint to be used. Just real quickly, some background for you. This was an issue that some of the committee members, I believe mostly in conference committee, heard about last session. Sue Aberholden from NAMI will provide some background on some efforts in 2009 to put some language in regarding the use of restrictive procedures. But that statute was silent on it wasn't clear whether or not districts could use prone restraint. On May 11th of 2011, the department sent an email to special ed directors informing them that under the restrictive procedure statute, the prone restraint was not permitted. But what the statute says is the statute says procedures which prohibit physical holding that restricts or impairs a child's ability to breathe. We believe that that statute was unclear, and we had concerns about the interpretation by the department, so we brought some language that we worked out with NAMI to the conference committee last year, which was adopted, to allow the use of prone restraints for 1 year if a district has provided to MDE a list of staff that have had specific training on the use of prone restraints, information on the type of training that was provided and who provided the training. It stated that prone restraints could only be used by staff who have received specific training, and in the restrictive procedure statute, it specifies which staff can use prone restraint or can use restrictive procedures. It requires that each incident of the use of prone restraint must be reported within 5 working days. Then it was either on a form provided by MDE or on a form chosen by the school district. The special session bill also said prior to using prone restraint, a district must review any known medical or psychological limitations that contraindicate the use of prone restraints. And then it required the department to submit a report to the chairs of the education committees by February 2013. So this bill has all of those current requirements would remain in place. We've just asked for an extension by 1 year to allow school districts more time to look at this issue and for us also to work with advocates on trying to find a resolution. Over the course of the interim, the intermediate special ed directors, the folks from MACE, met with the various advocates, which included NAMI, PACER, ARC, the Disability Law Center, and to the extent possible, the department was also at those meetings to talk about the prone restraint law and trying to find a resolution. What we came to, which was not agreed to by all parties, but what we came to was an extension, requesting an extension by 1 year. I will have testimony from the Intermediate District 916 to talk about the practical implications of not allowing an extension. And I'm going to let Sue Abderholden come speak next about the work that NAMI has done on the bill and their position on the compromise.
Thank you. Welcome, Ms. Abderholden.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. And we are a grassroots organization dedicated to improving the lives of children and adults with mental illnesses and their families. And nearly 100% of our staff and board either live with a mental illness or have a family member. I'd like to put this bill into context so you understand how far we have come. As noted in the department's report, there was a task force that met to revise the state rules on the subject, but they couldn't come to any agreement. Because of the problems that NAMI heard, their use in non-emergency situations, long hours in seclusion, et cetera, we then invited experts from both schools and the mental health community to work to create a community consensus for restricting seclusion and restraint procedures in schools. In addition to continuing supporting school districts to use positive behavioral interventions and supports, there was a consensus created to propose legislation that defined emergency seclusion and restraints, permitted their use only in emergency situations when the child is in danger of hurting themselves or others or major property damage, permitted their use only by trained staff, allowed schools to plan for emergencies so they could talk about it in the IEP, required schools to determine how to document, report, and review the use of seclusion restraints, and it prohibited certain actions or procedures. Legislation was introduced and passed during the 2009 legislative session that reflected this consensus. While it was not, in our eyes, a perfect bill, we believed it was a significant step forward. It was more than we had, and it certainly contained the key elements. We gave school districts 2 years to prepare for its implementation, knowing that they would need time to train staff and rewrite their policies before it went into effect on August 1st. I'd now like to talk about why NAMI is supporting this particular bill. The Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration, which has a nationwide effort to reduce the use of seclusion and restraints on children and adults with mental illnesses, states that it takes a planned effort, including data collection and analysis, strategies for organizational change, staff training, risk assessment, debriefing, and an adequate number of staff for any organization, including a school, to move towards zero use of seclusion and restraints. NAMI does not like prone restraints, and we would like to see their use discontinued. But I just want to remind committee members that our law for schools has only been in place for 7 months. We are at the beginning of this effort, and it takes time, commitment, and resources to truly reduce and eliminate them. The MDE report is the first of its kind, and it needs much more discussion. In our discussions, particularly with intermediate districts, we've seen a concentrated effort to train staff, use debriefing sessions, analyze the data, and try to do things differently. This is the very first time that we have collected district data on the use of seclusion and restraints and statewide data on the use of prone restraints. So while the use of prone restraints is higher than expected, we have absolutely no comparison. We have no idea how much it was used before. In addition, with so few months of implementation, we didn't expect the new tools that staff learned to be second nature. And even in schools where it is high, now what? We didn't provide any teeth in the law, any opportunity for MDE to intervene when they are used in non-emergency situations, nor did we provide money for training and technical assistance. Because a high percentage of children who had prone restraints used on them were in the EBD category, NAMI has a real concern about what happens to them, many of whom have a serious mental illness. And some of them have CASI scores that would qualify them for day or residential treatment. We are genuinely worried about unintended consequences, such as more children being placed on homebound because the intermediates cannot keep them or their staff safe in the school, which would place a huge burden on families, more children diverted to day treatment where we already have problems regarding payment and coordination with education and transportation, increased use of police, who do not have training on the use of prone restraints and will result in some children ending up in the juvenile justice system, and increased use of reasonable force, which is allowed under education statutes and for which we don't have the same reporting requirements. The solution isn't to ban prone restraints at this time, as much as I don't like them. It is to continue to develop alternatives, and I would go a step further, a comprehensive plan. It's not just training of school staff. It's a more robust mental health system that provides for more collaboration between schools and intensive treatment options, more school-linked mental health services, so children can obtain clinical services that are easily accessible and where they are more likely to complete the treatment plans, streamlining the funding streams for education and transportation services for day treatment, and only allowing true clinical day treatment programs to call themselves a day treatment program, allowing for children in day treatment and residential treatment programs to have access to year-long education so they aren't so behind when they return to school, and being behind and facing stressful tests and educational challenges only exacerbates the problem, supporting programs that teach social and emotional learning, encouraging schools to refer children earlier to mental health services without worrying that they will be financially responsible for clinical services, and providing MDE with staff time and training money so that they can actually provide technical assistance to schools that are higher users of seclusion restraints and where they are used in non-emergency situations. NAMI worked hard in 2008 and 2009 to create a community consensus and to develop and pass a bill because we care about what happens to children, particularly those who live with a serious mental illness. The MDE report only came out this month, and there has not been an opportunity to, again, bring everyone together to create a consensus about how to move forward. NAMI is in the process of using a CURA intern to survey schools on the implementation of the entire seclusion and restraint law, and we plan on coming back next session with amendments. By extending the deadline for another year, it keeps the pressure on to develop a comprehensive plan. We know it's our kids who have these procedures used on them, our kids who make up 70% of the juvenile justice system, our kids who have one of the highest dropout rates, and our kids whose mental health needs are not nearly as stressed as they should be. Our position was not taken lightly, but 8 months ago, we had nothing, and now we have a beginning. We want our children in school and in their family homes. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions of Ms. Aberholton? Okay. Do you have any other testifiers, Senator Wolf?
Yes, sir, Madam Chair. I don't have a copy of the agenda.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry.
Connie Hayes?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Connie Hayes, superintendent at Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. Today we want to share a video with you that will help you understand the context for the use of prone restraint in our schools. And I have several staff here with me today who train other staff how to use prone restraint in an effective and safe way. They're here to answer any questions if you might have some specifics. The intermediate school districts don't want to use prone restraint. Right now, we need to use it only when necessary to keep students and staff safe. It is difficult to really understand the need you have until you understand the students, their families, and our staff. The intermediate school districts hope that in the near future, we have a chance to have a much broader policy discussion about the mental health needs of these children in our public schools. But for today, those needs, well, that is the context we feel you must understand as you consider policy on the use of prone restraint. Recently, I was talking to someone who politely interrupted me and asked, "Are there really more kids with these kinds of extreme needs?" I don't want to say people don't believe us when we talk about these needs, but I do understand most people think about what we describe through the lens of their own experience in a typical K-12 school, and it's very difficult to conceptualize. 10 to 15 years ago, when our member school districts enrolled their most difficult students in our Level 4 special education programs, the students had disabilities that most people recognize, students with Down syndrome, and students with significant mental and physically handicapping conditions who need wheelchairs. We don't see very many students with those kinds of disabilities anymore. And here's one data point to demonstrate that. We have seen a threefold increase in elementary age students with extremely aggressive behavior in just the last 4 years. And based on the incoming referrals, we see no change in that trajectory. We want to share this video with you today so that you can begin to understand that, yes, there are more children with very significant mental health needs in our programs. And these needs often manifest themselves in unpredictable, erratic, and very aggressive behaviors. As you view this video, I want you to imagine how these challenges translate to the older, bigger, and increasingly more aggressive students we serve at our other school sites as well.
Hello, I'm Connie Hayes, superintendent at Northeast Metro 916 Intermediate School District. We provide educational services to our 10 member districts in the northeastern part of the Twin Cities. What I'm going to show you today is a window into a troubling trend the three intermediate districts are facing. I'm here today at our alternative learning program at John Glenn Middle School. This is a full-day program for elementary-age children with autism spectrum disorder and emotional behavioral disorder whose needs are so complex that they simply cannot be met at their home district. Since we can't bring you here to our program, we're going to bring our students, their families, and our staff to you. We've chosen this particular school because it illustrates perfectly our dual challenges. Serving students whose decline in mental health support are contributing to an unsafe learning environment and an unsafe working environment. And the difficulty of educating and supporting this complex student population in a building designed for traditional learning. While this hallway is quiet today, it is where much of the action takes place during the school day because it is the only place we have to de-escalate students when they go into crisis. The examples you're going to see are relatively mild. We have chosen not to share with you the most complex, challenging examples out of respect for our students and their families. Thank you for allowing us to share our story with you.
Increase in the area of elementary programming from almost 30 students to 98 students at the end of last year. That trend is a bit frightening.
When we read the reports of what we're getting when we're getting a new student, just the description of the behaviors and the mental health conditions that they have, they start to not really sound like kids anymore.
The intensity of the illness of these children is much greater than ever before. Because kids this ill used to be in hospitals, or they were in a residential treatment center. There's no money to pay for all those things.
We're getting referrals to us from kids who are 5 years old in kindergarten, and that hasn't happened ever.
The vast majority of kids and adolescents who have mental health problems receive no mental health treatment whatsoever.
We all deserve to have our own health and happiness. And for many young people who are experiencing these kinds of challenges, basic health and happiness is really hard to come by.
In the state of Minnesota, we have no statutory obligation to provide for the mental health needs of children. We do have a law that says kids have a right to a free education. That's appropriate. There is an assumption that the mental health needs of these children can be met in the schools. So the schools end up a dumping ground.
The mental health challenges many of these students are facing really create a barrier for them to be able to engage in learning how to do math and learning how to read so that they can be successful as young people when they become adults.
I think that 75% of our energy is put towards crisis and behavior management, and 25% of the energy is put towards academics.
A student that lacks mental health support, I think the stresses not only on that student but on the family are enormous.
we spend a lot of time trying to connect family and build families up, but it's a very, very difficult time for them when there's limited opportunities to get help. They've been hurt by a system that has failed them.
These kids are really sick. Parents all by themselves can't do this. We can't do it. We need help.
If I could wave a magic wand, you would call up someone and say, okay, here's what I've done so far. Come and hang out with my child and tell me what my other options are. What else can I do? I've tried everything I've thought of. What else can I do to help him?
Kids that have emotional behavioral disorders or have behavioral autism are looked at so negatively sometimes, and that's not who they are. It's just a part of what they deal with.
People who have physical disabilities or injuries are recognized as having something wrong with them, and people with mental health, they don't look any different.
Brain illness, brain injury, brain damage. It's invisible.
So then it's, oh, your parenting skills aren't good. You must not be doing a good job because you can't control your child. Why is he acting like that?
The child has no control over the behavior. It's purely a manifestation of the mental health disorder.
He gets to a point where he cannot control his reactions. And it becomes possible that he could hurt other people just without even knowing it. And he's always remorseful. But at that moment, he can't control what he's doing.
I think I can say with great confidence that none of the teachers we have here at 916 would have ever believed when they were becoming trained as a special ed teacher that they would be facing the kinds of injuries they face on a day-to-day basis. These students can go into crisis very quickly.
Sometimes it feels like a blow up, like the school just blew up because like four kids are going off at once and like we don't have enough space to, you know, adequately handle it, and like that gets really tough.
It's hard to see other people get injured. Mm-hmm. Seeing people get hit in the head so hard that they get a concussion, it's heartbreaking that you weren't there, to help it.
I'm getting concerned that we're going to be able to keep staff working in this environment.
Even though they do have these really intense behaviors and really intense needs, they're still 75% like other kids.
We formed this ridiculous bond over Batman, and that has just been huge. It's positive play, it's a positive relationship, it's positive interactions. Instead of saying his name, it's, come on, Batman, let's do this. And he's so much more willing to do that as somebody else than himself. Because sometimes being this kid is so much.
They want to play with the other kids. They want to be in games with them. They want to learn. They want to develop friendships. They want to say sorry when someone gets hurt. They just don't know how to do it.
The highs, it's so rewarding when the kids are on and you're having a great time with them and they're learning and you see successes. It's amazing. Yeah. But the lows are so low that it's like, that alone being such a range is just emotionally like, oh, like it's exhausting.
And they're so moldable still. You know, these kids still have amazing left in them. They're not bad kids. They just make bad choices.
Children are precious, and they need for us grown-ups to be taking really good care of them. We need to know what their needs are, and then we need to appropriately provide for them.
Yeah, there's a part of me that wonders when is it going to end, and it hurts me to see kids leaving our school in an ambulance.
Until we put all of the puzzle pieces together, we're going to continue to be very stressed in finding a way to help the young people that are being placed in our programs to be successful as young adults.
Madam Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Hayes.
Thank you very much for your attention to our video. I'm going to pass the mic to our Director of Special Education. He's going to help you take you through an example of a prone restraint so you understand how we use it in our programs.
Madam Chair, Committee, I'm Dan Natus. I'm the Director of Special Education for Northeast Metro Intermediate District 916. Hopefully you have in front of you a document that looks like this. It would be an example of one of the reports that we have to send to the MDE each time we use a prone restraint. I'd like to share with you the report that was sent this fall on one of our students. This is an example of a student situation where academic demands triggered a behavioral incident that ended in the use of prone restraint. At 9 o'clock, the student was working with a staff on math and was asked to read a word that they had read earlier. The student escalated very quickly and became aggressive. Staff determined that they needed to remove the student so it wasn't so disruptive to the classroom. For the next 40 minutes, our staff responded using proactive strategies and did not move immediately into a restrictive procedure. For the next 18 minutes, our staff continued to engage in de-escalation techniques while the student cycled between escalating and de-escalating and then increased the behavior to a point where the student became dangerous to themselves and to our staff. At which time, during those 18 minutes, we did 4 prone restraints, all of which lasted under 30 seconds. Then for the following 30 minutes or so, the student began to de-escalate and went back to being on task. I wanted to share this example to describe the efforts our staff go to in an attempt to de-escalate a student before engaging in a prone restraint. Because of the student's history of self-injurious behavior of headbanging, seclusion is not an option. And when other forms of holding break down, a prone position is the safest and most effective position for this student. Another important part of our procedure is debriefing with our staff. And when time permits, we try to do that immediately after the situation, but always at the end of the day. Debriefing means reviewing the student's behavior plan, trying to figure out what works, what doesn't work, and try to problem solve the situation. This debriefing strategy has helped reduce the number of prone restraints from the beginning of the school year to currently, or at the end of the time, reporting an MDE by 35%. It's a very positive strategy for us. I also would like to comment on staff injuries. Because our staff that intervene with students are trained to use prone restraint safely, we have had only 4 injuries to our staff, which were 2 injuries requiring that were scratches to their arms and 2 that were kicks that required some attention. We have had staff injuries during the escalation of behavior and the intervention prior to the use of prone restraint. Those number ranges upward in the 80s to 90s in terms of injuries. When I ask my staff if we can't use prone restraint in emergency situations with a very few number of kids, what would be the potential consequences? Their response is increase in police involvement, increase in calls for emergency personnel to respond, hospitalization, increase in staff to manage behavior, an increase in safety concerns for all staff and students. Injuries are more likely to occur during a continued aggression, if not stopped, and the need for more space. I'd also like to point out some of the disclaimers in the Minnesota Department of Education report on page 12. I don't know if you've seen the report. When you do, on page 12, they note a few of the disclaimers which are important to note. First of all, it was a short reporting period. There was only 4 months to report data. This questions the validity of the data trends. We need more time to look at this problem. It's very complex. There was inconsistency in forms and reporting. Different districts use different forms, and we need to standardize how we report information. And then outliers. Within 916, we had 2 students who accounted for 65% of all of our prone reports and 65% of all of our incidents. These 2 students accounted for 188 prone incidents, which was 32% of all incidents in Minnesota. Across Minnesota, 1 student accounted for 8% of all reports, 4 students 21%, and 10 students 36% of all reports. I tell you this because this is not widespread use of prone restraint, but rather a small number of students that require this type of response. Clearly, these are very complicated children and at times very aggressive. Prone restraint is not an intervention, but a response to a dangerous situation where student and staff safety is paramount. We welcome the opportunity to work with the advocacy groups, NAMI, and the MDE to create ways to reduce and eliminate the use of prone restraints in the future. At this point, we need to continue to use this to keep our staff and students safe in our schools. Thank you.
Mr. Nadit, is it Nadit?
Yes.
What would it take to eliminate? I mean, if these incidents occur, is there anything known or is it not yet discovered in terms of what kind of approaches could be effective in without engaging in prone restraint?
I wish that it was a simple answer for that question, but it's far more complex. The students that we are receiving in our district come to us with a great deal of difficulty, mental health problems, emotional behavioral disorders. We work very hard at trying to identify the triggers, looking at the behavior individually for each student. I think we need to, as Sue Aberholden said, and Connie is talking about, wrap around kids. We need to kind of join our forces to work from all fronts to try to solve this problem with kids.
Are you aware of any research that's going on beyond the people who are directly working with the children or young adults on these behaviors? Is there any research that might lead to some responses? Because we're dealing with an edict that said you shall not use, and then we tried to delay, and then we're delaying again. Well, I'm trying to look for some hope.
Yes, I believe there is hope. I believe that working together, we can continue to reduce how we intervene with kids. I think we need to gather more information. And I'm concerned about if we weren't able to intervene with a small number of kids in a way to keep staff safe and to keep students safe, that it's going to be put some great hardship on our programs and our families and students.
And I'm also interested in what kind of actions could also give comfort level to the people that this is not being overused. You know, I think our three intermediate districts, I've been most familiar with 287, and the superintendent has shared, I think, here and in other situations, some of the extreme risks that staff have. It's a wonder that they want to subject themselves to this. And I don't know what percentage the three intermediates represent in terms of dealing with these behaviors or the children that are that have the most extreme challenges in this area. I'm rambling here. But looking for some kind of a positive way, rather than just kind of saying we're going to shut it down, is that pressure needed in order to come up with a solution, which it seems to me like it's a work in progress, that nobody really has those answers yet. Where are they going to come from? Do you think just talking among the interest groups is going to develop and create the strategies that it will take to remove that necessity? Ms. Dawson wants to say something, if she can deal with it.
I don't have to deal with microphones very much, Madam Chair. Thank you again, Valerie Doeslin. I represent the intermediate school districts. I think that you will hear from advocates that have concerns about an extension on the prone restraint, and we certainly want them to be able to share their concerns, and I wouldn't want to try to speak for them. When the bill was heard on the House side, we had a discussion that we would an agreement that we would continue to have a discussion. And we are going to be trying to work this week to try to address their concerns. And so I don't have any
any solutions to present for you today, but I'm hoping we can continue that discussion. As I said, I'll let the people who have concerns voice their concerns rather than me trying to interpret that. But we continue to try to want to work with the advocacy community. We would like to find a resolution that's agreeable to all parties involved.
Thank you. There's Nan Records.
Madam Chair, before these two leave.
Yeah. Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Senator Tomasoni.
Maybe, Madam Chair, maybe this is premature. I was just looking at the amendment and the language in the amendment. Do you want to wait on that? Or?
Well, if it was, is it related to some of the things they said that you just wanted to raise a question? Or
I'm just wondering, on page 1, line 1.34, it has prohibitions. And then the change comes on page 2, line 215. And I was just wondering if the witnesses were okay with that, because it seems to me it goes really, really far. And I'm just wondering if you could live with it, because what I saw in the film was I saw a smaller kid, but if it's a bigger kid and you need to hold them down or something, I don't know that you can do that without doing some of the things that are listed in this. So I don't know what, I'm just trying to find out if people who deal with the situation are okay with that language.
Ms. Gosselin?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, Senator Tomasoni, yes, we are okay with the language. This language in the amendment was part of the department's report with some suggested changes. I am no expert on the use of prone restraint, and certainly I think Mr. Naditz or maybe Ms. Records might be able to explain, but my understanding is that this is, we are okay with the language, and it won't inhibit our ability to use prone restraints according to training that the districts receive.
And so, Madam Chair?
Yeah, Senator Tomasoni.
And because it seems to me number 9 is pretty good the way it is without new language, but I'm just wondering if I could see where you might have to sit on a kid sometime. And you don't have to?
No.
Never? Okay. All right. All right. Then as long as you guys are okay with it, I'm okay with it.
So I think what's not included here is ankles, feet, hands, and wrists.
Okay. All right.
That must be it.
Right.
Okay. Ms. Records?
Thank you, Madam Chair and esteemed members of the committee. I'm Nan Records, and I am the Director of Special Education for the Sherburn Northern Rite Special Ed Cooperative. We serve students in the districts of Becker, Big Lake, Monticello, and St. Michael Albertville. Our total student population is 16,000 students, and we serve just over 12% in special education. So on December 1st, we had what's called a child count of 1,926 students identified as special education. I also serve on the Minnesota Administrators for Special Education, or MACE, board. And so I'm here today on behalf of MACE and also on behalf of my individual districts, their families, and our staff and students. In the report that was prepared for you by the Department of Ed on the use of prone restraints in Minnesota schools, it should be noted that one of my member districts is identified in the report as submitting to MDE 9 reports on the use of prone restraints since August 1st. The 9 reports, or 12 incidences, that MDE broke into represent one student of our 1,926 students. To date, we have used prone restraint for 186.5 minutes for this one student. This represents 0.0047% of the time that we've had with him to educate since the first of the school year. In a larger perspective, and maybe this helps to answer one of your questions that you had, Madam Chair, to date of our 1,926 special ed students that have attended school since the first of the start of the school year, they've attended for approximately 85 million minutes of school. And of that time spent, 0.00002265% we have spent implementing a prone restraint. Now, this is in no way meant to minimize that 0.0002265% of that student or staff's time spent in a prone restraint, but it's meant to illustrate that this is a procedure that is not overutilized. It is not used as a means of behavior management, but as a means of gaining control of an aggressive child in order to protect that child or others from physical injury. And it is definitely not our first means that we go to for implementation. Need to also point out that, just as Dan had spoken earlier, that we don't use the other restrictive procedures for this student, the other uses of physical holds that are permitted or seclusion, because they have proved highly ineffective with this student. Our emphasis is always on de-escalating and using of positive behavior supports. Our last resort is that of physical restraint. I would suggest to you that a same calculation that I did for my member districts could be done on the statewide data, and you would probably get a similar percentage, so to put it into perspective of how often it's used. Included in MDE's report to you, you have recommendations for improvement, and MACE is in support of the number of the MDE's recommendations, and I was glad to hear that those have been included now. That I'm hoping the one of supporting the positive behavior interventions and support, absolutely that recommendation we would support, because anything that can be done to provide districts with resources to implement PBIS or positive behavior interventions and support is absolutely essential. Clarifying the definitions of what prone restraint is and defining what it is and isn't allowed, and expanding on the required purpose of a physical hold, MACE also supports. Now, there are two additional recommendations that you would find in that report that MACE and my member districts could not support. The first one being the consideration of an intermediate district-only limitation. You've heard from the intermediate districts. I'm here to talk about it from an outsider, from a perspective that is a single district. The reality of doing it, of limiting this to only intermediate district, is a frightening reality to me, because as the data reports, prone restraints have to be used in districts outside of the metro school districts that are served by your intermediate districts. And I'm in one such district. At first, I thought my testimony to you would be, well, we can't legislate where our children live. But in reality, imposing an intermediate district-only limitation would be a way of limiting or of legislating where our children live. Because the sad reality would be that outstate districts would have to be recommending residential placements into metro school districts to get served by an intermediate district. My one student would be in this reality. Prone restraint is our last resort, but it is one that we have to have as an option. I would suggest to you that in place of an intermediate district-only limitation, MDE would work to support those outstate districts to ensure that staff have proper training opportunities. The second recommendation appearing in MDE's report that MACE could not support is that of requiring a nurse or other medical professional be present during prone restraints. I'm not sure what other medical professional MDE means by this reference. I, for one, know my districts don't have other medical professionals as resources within our schools. It must be noted that as part of the training before implementing a prone restraint, all staff are to be trained in observing the student's physical and psychological status throughout the restraint. That's already in statute. And nursing services are limited in our schools. Oftentimes, they are assigned to multiple buildings within a district. The data in MDE's report indicates that approximately half of the 455 incidences of prone restraint lasted for less than 1 minute, and nearly 90% lasted for less than 5 minutes. The possibility of having a nurse present in less than a minute is highly unlikely. This requirement would lead to major staffing implications and impose a burdensome cost to districts. And basically, the only way that I could ensure compliance with such a requirement would be to hire a nurse specifically for the students that we're required to use a prone restraint on. I thank you, Madam Chair, and other members of the committee, for your opportunity to testify this afternoon. Thank you for considering the points presented. I conclude with emphasizing the point that has been made throughout the testimony this afternoon, is that the common interest across all of the various interest groups is the same, creating safe environments to educate all children. And through collaboratively working to that goal is essential for our students. This allowing us additional time to do that work is essential. Thank you.
Thank you. May I ask a question that maybe probes in a little different direction? I assume you don't have this one student that you're having to deal with prone restraint, is not with you 24/7.
Not with us 24/7.
So
no.
In the environment that they go home to, mm-hmm. Is the family or the caregiver confronted with some of the same kinds of behavior as what you're experiencing there? And what kind of communication or work do you have with them that either helps them or helps you?
That's an interesting question. I'm glad you asked. In fact, I had hoped to have the parent present today to provide some testimony, and maybe if we have an extension and we're back here next year, she can be here as well. We took the approach that oftentimes when you're having to do something as an extreme as prone restraint, that sometimes we, you know, you can see on the picture, but you had the understanding that perhaps we're sitting on a child at some point or another, that we felt it was very important for our parents to understand fully what a prone restraint was. And so we supported her through going through the training as well. So she is trained. In fact, sometimes our challenge with our child is him not coming to school. So we have a unique program in which we go to his home and sometimes have to educate him in the home. Our reports to MDE will note that the mom at times has had to be one of the people involved in the prone restraint. So that is the situation that we feel that, you know, the parent has fears that if we don't have this option, what will happen is what has been described is, probably likelihood of having to call, you know, law enforcement becoming involved or looking for a much more restrictive setting. This child has been on a waiting list to get into one of the intermediate districts simply because I'm considered outstate. I'm not very outstate when you think about St. Michael and Monticello and Becker and Big Lake, but it's not an option because they're not taking out a district, you know, out of their metro districts. And so we would then be looking at having to make a recommendation for a residential placement so that child could live in one of the districts that would then be servicing by an intermediate district if that was that option there. So
thank you very much. Are there any questions of Mr.
Madam Chair?
Senator Snow.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, is it... do you see change in the child? And I'm not, you know, I don't know whether it's change in his or her educational growth or change in behavior over time.
It's an exciting child, and if because we have seen progress, at a point that all of the other options weren't working for us. We've got two outside agencies that we contract for their services to help us on behavior management. And then to look at all that we were doing in a proactive approach. When it came to, as our last resort, this is one that has been very effective with this child. Our rate of use of this has decreased tremendously over, you know, when we started it a year ago January to where we are now.
And Madam Chair, just a follow-up on that. Are most of the students that are, and I assume that there aren't many of them, but are they on some level of medication, or do they, how do you know when they come to school whether their medication has been taken or not taken?
Medication is an individual family decision and not one that schools become involved in making those recommendations. In certain family situations, that's a choice that they don't want to go into medical, you know, into medicating their child, and that is the case here. And we respect that, and we, you know, our challenge, our obligation, our responsibility, our desire is to educate him and all children, regardless of what they come to. And so that medication piece is an individual family decision. Certainly those that are on medication, there are ways that we can tell sometimes fairly quickly if they haven't taken their meds in the morning. We sometimes work with families that if it's difficult to make that a routine practice, we make it a part that they get their medication then at school. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think we have two more, Steve Larson and Dan Stewart. Could you come to the both come to the table and
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. I'm Steve and committee members. I'm Steve Larson, the Senior Public Policy Director with the ARC Minnesota. The ARC advocates for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities and their families, and we oppose the use of prone restraint. In the Minnesota Department of Education's recent report, it stated that 15 states specifically prohibit the use of prone restraint, which is defined as any restraint in which a child is held face down. So our question today is, why is Minnesota not one of those states? Unfortunately, the report did not contain information about how the other 15 states accomplished this goal, and I think that's something that we certainly need to find some information on as quickly as possible. Again, in the MDE report on page 7, it states that on December 1st, 2011, a settlement was reached between the state of Minnesota and the plaintiffs in the Minnesota Extended Treatment Option lawsuit. And I quote, pursuant to the settlement in the Mito case, the programmatic use of prone restraint among many other types of restraint are not allowed in similar DHS licensed facilities serving residents with developmental disabilities for the purpose of changing behavior through punishment. This prohibition is based in relevant part on the recognition that asphyxiation is a risk factor for the use of prone restraint. In 2009, as it was stated earlier, comprehensive legislation was passed addressing the need for reducing the use of seclusion and restraint in Minnesota schools. This legislation went into effect on August 1, 2011. Near the end of the 2011 session, there was a debate on whether the 2009 legislation included the ban on the use of prone restraints. A compromise was reached for 1 year, and I believe part of my contribution to that compromise was to suggest a 1 year time limit. So we think we should stick with the one-year time limit. In MDE's report, during this brief reporting period, prone restraint has been used 592 times in emergency situations, and we think that number is too high. 38% of the students have autism spectrum disorders, and they represent the greatest number of the incidents that are included in the report. There is a strong consensus in the disability community.
Do you know how many individuals that involved that 500 and some?
I would have to look that up in the report. Maybe I can get help from the audience on that one, Madam Chair.
Well, I think we were hearing that in some of the situations that there may have been a substantial number, but it was only one student.
Madam Chair, I believe that's correct.
Madam Chair, my name is Dan Stewart. I understand from the department's report is that there was around 90 to 100 individual students for those 592 uses.
Thank you.
There's a strong consensus in the disability community that prone restraint should be eliminated, but there are differences about how we can achieve that goal. What is lacking is a plan. If our goal is to eliminate prone restraint, then there must be a plan to get there. Extending the use of prone restraint for one more year without a plan will not help us accomplish this goal. We suggest that a plan be included be developed with timetables and implemented by August 1st, 2012 so that we can strive for the elimination of prone restraint as soon as possible. If there's a work group or a task force that needs to address this, we are certainly willing to participate on this. As a result of the Mito lawsuit, a DHS has established what is known as a Rule 40 committee that will be addressing similar issues. Let's bring the expertise of the education, human services, and disability communities to the table to end the practice of prone restraint that puts both the student and practitioners at risk of harm. Thank you for this opportunity.
I don't know if you have suggested, but I would think that as a part of the group that is going to come up with those recommendations, that a substantial number ought to be people who have had experiences that, in fact, have demanded that without having any other kinds of options. It's easy to sit at a table, you know that happens here even at the legislature, and come up with ideas and not have a clue as to what that means for the people that are having to respond and deal with it. And so I would really encourage you, because this is a serious matter, and I'm not trying to in any way belittle your goal, but there's a reality there that has to be a part of that. I don't know if your organizations have done that. We probably can pursue the if you have any information about the states that already ban it and what any contacts there. I think that could be useful to us. Or if you have made those kind of contacts, could provide that kind of information as to how they have managed to do it and what they're using in its place.
So thank you, Madam Chair. Those are excellent suggestions, and that's exactly how the Rule 40 Committee is made up that I just referenced.
Thank you. And you have some additional words?
Yes. Madam Chair, members, my name is Dan Stewart. I'm an attorney at the Minnesota Disability Law Center. We're a statewide project of legal aid. We're also part of the National Disability Rights Network, which is a federal protection and advocacy system. We receive federal funds to protect and advocate for individuals with disabilities across the age and disability spectrum. I'm here to testify in opposition to this bill as it currently stands. We believe that the prone restraint procedure is simply too risky. There are too many variables for each and every student that's out there. There are medication issues. There are known and unknown medical issues involved. And there are so many different variables that we can't really predict which children may end up dying as a result of the prone restraint or being substantially injured. The Department of Education's report from February of this year is especially concerning to us because of the high number of uses. As noted before, there are 592 separate incidents. There were over 130 in November, over 140 in December. And December was a short month. We didn't have a complete data set for January, so it seems like the number of uses is continuing to increase rather than decrease. There are also repeated uses on the same student. This suggests to me that the prone restraint is not stopping the underlying behavior. Unless we stop the underlying behavior, this is just going to be a common, habitual, and repeated practice in Minnesota schools with all those different risks. There's also information in the Department of Education's report that says that the use of prone restraints is racially disproportionate. Certainly that needs to be looked into as well. Madam Chair, you mentioned earlier the concern about whether or not we can successfully move towards elimination of prone restraint. I believe that there is. There are other states that have banned prone restraint. There are other schools in Minnesota that have similar types of populations that do not appear in the Department of Education reports. They are doing something. There's also other schools and other facilities in other states that do not use prone restraint, either by choice or because there's a ban. And I think that it's extremely critical to look at those states, to look at those experiences, consult with outside experts, and one thing the Minnesota Disability Law Center is doing is connecting with state, different experts in different states, university folks, others, to try to figure out what options are actually available besides prone because of the inherent risks of prone restraint. I've noted at today's testimony, as well as in the testimony in the House, that there seems to be a shared objective of not wanting to use prone restraints. I completely share that, but I think that having an extension to the legislation is not getting us towards that goal. We need to have that pressure on so that we can move towards the elimination of prone restraint. I'd also point out that the uses of prone restraint are in addition to other forms of restraint and lock seclusion that occur in Minnesota schools. So we do have a snapshot, but it's only a snapshot, and there are other forms of these procedures being used. I agree with many of the recommendations and suggestions that Ms. Abderholden had previously, especially the comprehensive plan. But I completely disagree on the timeline. We need to have that pressure. We have the resources at our disposal. We are advanced in our strategies and our tools, and we can move towards that. The ban does not need to be extended. We need to have that pressure. And again, I think we're having the ban continue on will not get us towards that overall effort, and I believe that we'll be back here in this committee or in other committees next year, and we'll be having the same type of debates. But let's work on the ban now. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You mentioned earlier on that the report showed some number of minutes. I did not note that, but you indicated there were some 100 or some number of students, 100 or so, that had been subject to this restraint in the report. How many of those students suffered death or severe harm as a result of the prone restraint?
Madam Chair and Senator, I do not understand that there's been any death or significant injury on any student in Minnesota. However, in 2005 or 2006, there was a student who was put into prone restraint in Rice Lake Treatment Facility, and she was put into a prone restraint there. She was airlifted here to a metro area hospital, and she did die here. There are other reports nationwide, but thankfully none in Minnesota.
And Madam Chair, I guess I'm just trying to understand. I appreciate the concern that people are expressing about the use of this form of restraint. But it would seem that if it's being applied in a way that is proper or, I was going to say, with some restraint, but however it might be, whatever the right word is, it seems that if it is done correctly, that the risk to students is not, at least not a permanent risk of harm to a student. I guess it's certainly possible that a student could be harmed, but I think there are other things that may happen in a school setting that could also result in severe injury or harm or even death just in normal course of activity. So I guess my point is that do we take the position that this form of restraint is absolutely inappropriate, even though at least in some recent history there have not been instances of that demonstrated to be harmful, recognizing that there could be, but is that the right approach to take when you are dealing with a situation in schools that I even wonder to what extent education can occur in that kind of circumstance? So I'm just asking, is that the approach that you're advocating for, of one of there should never permit this, even though there hasn't been a pattern or at least a significant issue with harm?
Madam Chair, Senator Larson. Hamm, that is our position, because we do think that the prone restraint is inherently at risk and that there are other procedures, many of which have been referred to today, that could be implemented. And we need to look at what the other states are doing and see how they attain that goal.
So thank you. Thank you very much. Unless are there other questions? Senator DeCrey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wolf, from my perspective, I have a problem with your bill, and that's that you're extending it just for 1 year. I am the father of a disabled child. He came through the special ed program in school. He's now 32 years old, still lives with my wife and I. My wife also in the past has managed some group homes. There's been times when I understand in school a student got very unruly in the same classroom as my son, who's pretty defenseless in his wheelchair. And I want to know that my child can be protected, because to clear a room out and say you're going to begin to bring a child under control is unrealistic, because life happens quickly. And I want to know that the teacher, especially if they have a child in that classroom who is susceptible to these types of behaviors, is well-trained, because according to my wife, she has been in some group homes where she's also had some people working there who maybe used it inappropriately from time to time. So I think training is very important. I think having the right people employed is very important. But having that ability to act quickly to keep the other children safe is imperative.
Thank you, Senator DeCrey. I hope that people have heard the message. Senator Wolf?
Madam Chair.
You want to renew your motion to move?
I would like to renew and keep in mind that this is a bill that will allow data to continue to be taken dialogue to continue to be made to look at. I don't. One of my areas is EBD, and I have dealt with severe behavior issues, and it is a dilemma. Nobody has an intent, and I've never seen it used in a form of changing behavior of a student. It's purely as a form of ensuring safety of students as well as staff. And so while that would be wonderful to be able to eliminate this type of restraint, I would be real leery about discussion of eliminating it without having seen what we would replace it with. And to make sure, number one, that everyone stays safe. Number two, to make sure that we keep kids as much as possible in a classroom setting and not homebound or the need for being in a an institution, for lack of a better word. And so this bill is simply asking for another year to gather data and to make sure that we go at this with a very eyes-wide-open approach when that decision comes. And the decision might be to eliminate it completely. The decision might be, no, we're doing it correctly, and there's a need for it. But I do think we need to have that one-year extension to get the best information needed for that decision.
So you are moving that Senate File 1917 be recommended to pass?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Is there any further discussion? As amended, I should
say. As amended.
Any further discussion? Not. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is passed. Thank you very much, Senator Wolf. And Senator Thompson.
They wake you up.
Either side.
They wake you up.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and members, thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss Senate File 577. I do have an author's amendment. I assume that is what is being passed out now. Is that correct? No? Got it right there? All right. Now it's being passed out. Okay. It is an author's amendment to get the bill into the form of my preference. So at this point, Madam Chair, I would move the A2 amendment. If you want to wait until people get a chance to look at it, that's fine.
Is this the first hearing on your bill?
It is.
So this is an author's amendment?
Correct.
Okay. Senator Thompson moves the A2 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you.
Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and members, the bill before you, Senate File 577, addresses an issue that I think I'm not stretching it to say is of concern to people from all political perspectives and persuasions, and that is that we don't want to cross the line of using public money and public facilities to be advocating political points of view. And there are many schools in which that has become a problem over time. And in fact, the Attorney General has issued many opinions over time, dating back for sure to about 1966 and possibly even as far back as 1927. And the issue before us is simply whether we want to clarify and perhaps take a little bit further the restriction on the ability to use public facilities and public money in order to engage in campaigning for and against specific issues or candidates. And really what this is an attempt to do is more or less codify these attorney general opinions as well as a district court ruling that came down from the United States District Court here in Minnesota on a case that actually sprung up from the Lakeville School District, and I have a Lakeville School Board member here that will be speaking momentarily and addressing this issue as well. What we're trying to do is define political activities and attempt to prohibit political activities from taking place using school facilities, school resources, and the like. The bill also enumerates that districts must provide factual information to the public regarding local ballot initiatives, but there again can't advocate any particular point of view. Now, I believe that maybe it would make sense at this point to allow my testifier to go forth and explain her situation. So if it please the chair, I think before I take questions or we have discussion on it, I would like Michelle Volk to address the committee.
Okay. Welcome. Say your name for the record.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Michelle Volk. I am currently a school board member for the Lakeville School District, and I have been for over 10 years now. The Lakeville School Board does have a policy in place. I believe a copy has been given to everybody. It's our A100 policy, political campaigns and activities. This policy has been in place now for over 15 years. It was in 1997 that it went into effect. And it is working well. I'm going to kind of give you a little bit of background why the school district felt that they need to put the policy in place. A lot of our parents and public were complaining that there was just way too many campaign activities taking place actually in the school during the school day. People that most of our buildings are, you know, located on main roads as most schools are. And what was happening is some of the political campaign signs were actually up in teachers' windows in their classrooms, et cetera. So when the community members were driving by, you know, they were seeing different political signs, et cetera. Also, what was taking place is that some of our staff members actually taped some signs onto their desks, et cetera, so for the students to be able to see, you know, who they were supporting. Another thing that took place at our high school level, which got parents very upset, was the fact that they actually had some of our students stuffing envelopes, helping with flyers, these types of things during school hours. If they had time in their schedule, they could just go up to this room and help with these types of activities. And these were usually, you know, people that the union at this point was endorsing, et cetera. So with all those different things that went on, it became apparent that the Lakeville School District just kind of needed to do something. And I think the policy has been very fair. And the policy, as it's laid out, basically just tells our employees that they can't do any campaign activities during the school work hour day. And as Senator Thompson alluded to, this was held up in court. We were challenged because our staff wanted to be able to use the school mailboxes to be able to put flyers in for a presidential candidate that they were supporting and wanted to be able to put it in the boxes. And the court upheld our policy and basically said, you know, Lakeville has done a good job of being fair and adhering to their policy, so we're going to rule against you and in favor of the Lakeville policy. One of the things that makes this policy fair is if you look in Section C, is that the school board can vote to what we call pro forma. Basically, what it means is, let's say a PTO group would like to host a candidate debate, and it would take place in one of our buildings. A special request comes forward to the Lakeville School Board. It comes up with a date, time, building, etc. We vote on it, and then this activity can take place. So any candidates, any ballot initiatives can be discussed in that arena on school property. So it does allow for that. And the other thing, a couple years ago, our teachers union decided to form a vote yes committee for a school referendum. And I just wanted to tell you that they were able to stay within the policy guidelines, be able to get their message out to the public on their position, et cetera. And I think that the policy worked well for them. And A copy of our policy is available in all our school buildings. It's available in our student handbooks. Our administration goes over it each year with our staff members so that they can answer questions. Everybody understands the guidelines and is educated on what the policy means. The other benefit that as a school board member and as a parent, I think it also kept the district in line. You know, a lot of times we hear about political activities, you know, from other groups, but it also kept the district in line in realizing that they needed to make sure that they were putting out information that was factual and not taking a side on a position. I think that's about all I have, unless you can think of anything else, Senator Thompson.
No, the members may want to ask you questions, but that's just fine.
Senator Thompson, are there any questions of the witness?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a few questions, and if you could indulge me, Madam Chair, because I need to get to the final question through, because I need to ask the testifier if she's aware of a few things. Ms. Voll, is that correct?
It is.
Ms. Voll, are you in the bill that the author is presenting? A lot of these things are supposed to be happening. We're not supposed to be using funding to do this. So I think the clarification is an appropriate one. I don't have a problem with clarifying. But in the bill, there is a provision in that now is being amended. In the previous bill, in the original language that the author had, it says that the school board must provide the district's electorate with timely factual information about a pending ballot question. That language was moved to say that such policies should not prohibit the use of public funds for disseminating factual information about a proposition appearing on the local ballot. My question to you, as you have dealt with issues like this, are you aware of the ballot questions that are going to be that have been proposed during this session last year and this year that will appear in the ballot? Are you aware of that language? Do you know what they are?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Ms. Bolt.
Are we talking about some of the amendments that are going to be put forward to the public? Is that what you're talking about?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. Are you aware of those? Are you aware of that language? One proposal has already passed last year about same-sex marriage. You're aware of that?
Yes.
Okay.
The author
of this bill is proposing another constitutional amendment. It's called the Right to Work Amendment. Are you aware of that?
Yes.
And there is another constitutional amendment being proposed called the Voter ID Amendment. Are you aware of that?
Yes, ma'am.
And there is others probably coming. So my question to you is this. Do you believe that the schools should be engaged in providing information to students and families about what this language is about, knowing how polarizing and how incredibly controversial this language is? Do you believe that we need to pass legislation here today in this bill that instructs the schools to educate students and parents about this language and how this language will be proposed? Of course, the author is not by any means is proposing that schools take sides on it. He's just saying they need to educate. Is it appropriate to do that with the schools, with the school funding? Because we're going to use the school funding to do that.
Senator Torres-Ray, I think there may be maybe there needs to be further clarification of the language, but I don't think it's referring to the state constitutional amendments. It looks to me like it's on a local ballot. So it's more like your local referendum questions that you can provide factual information but not advocacy for it, which I think is maybe hard to view. But is there any particular definition of the local ballot? Is that it's related to a local issue then rather than the state issue? Senator Thompson.
No, Madam Chair, and I think Ms. Volk wanted to speak to that, but Yeah, if I understand correctly, Senator Torres-Ray, unless I'm missing the language you're referring to, I'm looking at lines 1.18 through 1.20, which talks about disseminating factual information about a proposition appearing on a local ballot. My understanding would be that that would refer to things that pertain specifically to the city, county, or school district. I don't know that that has to do with the statewide constitutional amendment issues. I can't believe it was anyone's intent to have it apply to that. If you felt we needed a clarification to narrow it down, that would be fine. But I believe a local ballot would refer to, say, for example, a school referendum or that type of thing.
And, Madam Chair, Senator Thompson, I do appreciate that because since we're giving amendments at the moment, it's hard to prepare for this. So the amendment, the amended language does have that. The language that I was prepared to speak about at this moment is a pending ballot question, and that's how you had framed your legislation, a pending ballot question. I was prepared to talk about that in that context, and now an amendment is being offered, so I haven't had a chance to really read it as carefully as I should, but I didn't have this language until about 2 minutes ago. So I do believe that there is a need to incorporate very specific language on a local ballot as it, you know, applies to school, because there is, I misunderstood the original language. I don't know if other members did, but when you said information about a pending ballot question, that's any ballot question, and we have many coming up.
We have
a local ballot, and there is no clarity as to what that means.
So Mr. Chairman, or Senator Torres-Ray and Senator Thompson, there either, I think, either could be a definition added as to what a local ballot encompasses, or maybe there is a reference, if there's already in statute some definition as to what that means.
Madam Chair.
If it does go to all local units of government, you know, generally you think of that as being, they're going to provide factual information. It's usually about a ballot question affecting that school district.
Right.
Which is a referendum, whether it be bond or operating or whatever.
Right. Madam Chair, to address that, yes, it's certainly my intent that that would apply to local initiatives, and we can work on that. One quick point that I also want Ms. Volk to be able to respond to Senator Torres-Ray's question, and that is the reason that this bill has been amended today is because some stakeholders have brought to my attention some issues that we actually want to resolve and work out before a vote. So I have received the permission of the chair to just lay this on the table today so everybody has a chance to take a closer look at it. And I'm going to be talking with some of the folks who are interested in the bill, and the chair has agreed to that but wanted to start the process of discussion today. But there's not going to be a vote taken today, so there will be time for people to have the opportunity to do that. And Ms. Volk, did you want to respond to her question?
I did. Thank you. You brought up some very good points, and according to Lakeville's policy that we have in place at this point, those activities would not be taking place within the school day. Of course, the district wouldn't at this point have any role in putting out information one way or the other. But as far as any of our employees wanting to advocate on a position during school hours, that would not be allowed. And so those types of questions have come up again as these ballot amendments are coming up and this bill is coming before you and the House. Our administration had said, you know, our policy is pretty clear, but, you know, could you make sure that the legislature kind of defines for us that we're in the right point and right place in the fact that we wouldn't allow those activities to take place within our school? The other point I'd like to make to you is that those are our policies for school hours. So if you as a representative wanted to send a questionnaire or a survey to our staff members, as long as they were answering your questions after hours, et cetera, on their own time, that can take place. Any kind of dialogue that they want to have after they're off the clock, as you would say, can take place. So the policy doesn't restrict freedom of speech.
Thank you. You've got a couple other, Senator Bonoff, but we've got a couple other testifiers. If they want to come forward, we'll take testimony today, and then we will lay it on the table as the author proposes. Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Thompson, I'm concerned about the bill. I look at, just as an example, I have a lot of concerns about the bill, but I'll start with on line 1.11, number 3, advocate the passage or defeat of any matter pending before a local school board, local governing body, the Minnesota legislature, or the Congress of the United States. As we debate education policy here at the legislature, where would we go to get information if not to our school districts and their representatives and our superintendents and their teachers? And they actually, in many cases, belong to organizations that hire lobbyists. And it's not, you're talking about any matter pending. Everything we deal with regard to education policy is a matter pending before the legislature. So I think that is something that really concerns me.
Senator Bonoff, are you reading the root of that they can't be sending us missives on their district computers? And you know, it's more related to the means that is the restriction. Whether they advocate or not, I think, is not the restriction. It's the restriction that the policies have to ensure that it's not using publicly funded resources for those.
Well, Madam Chair,
you have concern about that as well.
Well, it says, but not limited to time. So anytime we're in conversation with anyone who works for the school district, that's time. And so when I ask, you know, Superintendent Chase Anderson a question about what he thinks about a bill before me, I expect I want to be able to ask him during his school day, and that's not a conflict of interest. And so it seems to me that this language is so broad that we're actually putting a layer of governance and a barrier that is not appropriate. And then in addition, Senator Thompson, before I came to the legislature, I worked on referendum campaigns for Hopkins School District, and we were so clear about the laws. And we were told we could spend no money of Hopkins School District on a vote yes, and we had to raise money. And it just seemed that, I mean, and I was also co-chair of the Legislative Action Coalition. We, too, were very clear about where those boundaries were, where their lines were. I'm afraid that you're actually creating kind of a situation that would tie people's hands rather than provide what you're looking for, because I think the existing laws on the books are pretty darn good, and that if a school district finds themselves in a situation like Lakeville and wants to use local control to craft something more clear that would serve the benefit of that district, I think they should do that. But for us to put forward something that could, in fact, have far-reaching unintended consequences makes me very nervous.
Thank you. Well, you've got some more information to work on when it's laid on the table. Senator Thompson.
Madam Chair and Senator Bonoff, that actually is one of the provisions that some folks have raised some what I consider to be legitimate concerns about that will be discussed before this bill is voted on. So I appreciate you raising that issue, and I think that is something that needs to be discussed and ironed out.
Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Yeah, we have Senator Reeder.
I had one question, too. It might be an unintended consequence, but over the years, I've had visits from lots of delegations, particularly in the rural area, whether it's Bemidji, Brainerd, Rochester. It's not rural, but just students and staff, school board members, chamber, and they're all coming together, and they have a lot of specific legislative recommendations. It's usually for more funds for the schools, and there might be an employee with them, but they're all sharing that, and I don't think you'd want to have that type of restraint on their expression.
Senator Thompson.
Well, Madam Chair, I think a big part of that issue boils down to what Ms. Volk said, which is whose time are they using? Are they on their public time?
Yeah.
And whether they're advocating for or against a referendum or a levy, I don't think it's proper that government tools are used for that. Whether I agree with their position or not, that's not the purpose of taxpayer funding, is to essentially be backing political advocacy. But certainly that balance needs to be struck, and we don't want to restrain people from engaging in reasonable conversation, that's for sure.
Thank you. Mr. Kernquist and John, I don't know if I can say it, from Roseville. Still here?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Member Scott Kernquist with the Association of Metropolitan School District. And let me just say right off that Senator Thompson has been very open in working with us, as he mentioned, and we really appreciate that, and we intend to keep that dialogue going and trying to arrive at language that meets his goals, and then also we'll continue to allow your local school officials to communicate with legislators. So I think as Senator Bonna pointed out, it's really number three that is the area that we want to make sure is addressed, and that we don't end up with a situation where you aren't able to pick up the phone and call your local superintendent or a school board member or a business manager or a curriculum director and say, hey, we've got this bill that's moving through the legislature. How does it impact your school district? And we want to make sure that that school official could answer that question and say, well, either this is great, this would really help our school district, we think you should work on that, or whoa, that could really cause some significant problems for our school district and have some unintended consequences. So we want to make sure that is addressed. We think that the existing longtime attorney general's opinion really already does prevent school districts from expending resources and money on ballot questions and on political campaigns or races. And we fully support that, and we try to communicate that regularly to our members that is a no-no. But it's the pending legislation one that we want to continue to work with Senator Thompson on. So thank you, Madam Chair and members.
And Mr. Kernquist, does that apply to, because I sometimes get calls if things that are coming out over that computer. Now, that may not cost, the investment in the computer was made by the school district. But communicating, using those, if it isn't an identifiable cost, is restriction, do you think, in order as well?
Yes, Madam Chair and members.
Because it's school time.
And I think the policy that Board Member Volk talked about is one that I think other school districts have in place as well, and we think is a reasonable policy that districts could and should have in place.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes. Senator Zeeman.
Thank you. Could I ask Mr. Kernquist a question? Do you believe that same prohibition should apply to teachers? It would seem that if you think that we should be able to call principals on the phone or administrators, we as legislators should also be able to communicate with teachers and employees of the school district as well. I just wanted to see if you agreed with that statement.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Zeeman. Yeah, absolutely. It should be two-way, but we think that having a prohibition of maybe making those emails during instructional time when the staff should be engaged with students, we think that's a reasonable prohibition. But otherwise, we want to have that ability for a flow of communication that you can talk to your superintendent or your teachers about pending legislation and get their opinion.
Madam Chair, to that point.
Senator Tomasoni.
Just to follow up, so do you think it should be in law or do you think it should be a district policy? Because it seems to me that I mean, Senator Wolf could help me out here, but I'm pretty sure that, and so can you, Madam Chair.
Senator,
I'm pretty sure that all teachers have access to email right in their classroom, and I would be willing to bet that they're using it quite often while kids are taking tests or something like that, and I know that I have a lot of friends who are teachers who use the email. So I think you asked a very good question: is how can you police something like this when it's really not a cost? It's not a cost you can actually quantify because of the fact that the school district's paying for the internet, and then the teachers get to use the email, and as a result of it, is that a cost or isn't it a cost? So I don't know.
But we can, because if we get the emails, it says what time they were sent.
Right, but maybe that teacher isn't working at that time, or maybe they're on break, or maybe they're in the, So the question becomes, how do you determine these types of things? Is it something that should be put in law, or is it something that should be a school district policy is what I'm wondering.
Well, and Madam Chair and members, and I think the, if, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what Senator Thompson's legislation is would require a school district to develop that policy, and it would need to out to include the provisions here. And what we're saying is that what our concern is number three in this list, making sure that there's enough flexibility there to not stifle necessary communication between local officials and legislators.
Which would include email, which is in line 1.17.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You're right.
Okay. John Kay. Can
Kay.
I stop it there and then let you do the pronouncing?
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. My name is John Kisselyshyn, and that's Kisselyshyn. And yes, there are no vowels in there, just the letter Y. So
that's worse than my name.
Well, Madam Chair, welcome. Thank you. I have a handout here that the committee page is passing out here, and just for purposes of clarification, I want it to be known that the highlighting on here was done by myself on the email here on the first page. I've been a resident of the Roseville School District for the past 26 years. I have two children in the Roseville schools. I also served as mayor of the city of Roseville from 2000 to 2004. And I'm here today to cautiously speak in support of Senate File 577. My concern, though, is that the bill may not go far enough in addressing this issue. Now, in my opinion, the legislature primarily funds education, and I feel that the legislature has a responsibility to assure that funds are being spent appropriately. I mean, education dollars raised from taxpayers should not be spent on school board-supported political action committees. In my opinion, this is unethical and inappropriate. Unfortunately, though, this is being done in my school district today, and it has the support of the full school board. Now, several years ago, our school board created a group called the Roseville Area Schools Legislative Action Committee. The district has provided support staff, board support, email support, website support, access to information and lists that no member of the public could probably get access to. All of this, of course, is funded by the taxpayers. Now, the group claims to be nonpartisan and issue-oriented, but I have a handout here. The first page here is an email that I received from this group here last year. And if you take a look at this here, I've highlighted some key portions, but I would draw your attention to the bottom, the what you can say section. This is a partisan communication, in my opinion. This is not a nonpartisan, issue-oriented communication. This was sent by district staff to all of the parents that they had email addresses for in the entire Roseville school system. It took several employees in order to send out a communication like this. These lists were gathered using district resources, and then they're being put forth for this purpose. Now, I filed a complaint with the school board because this action violated at least two board policies and appeared to violate state campaign finance law. Board policy prohibits involvement in political issues. It requires that school resources only be used for educating students. State law says that no government employee may order another employee to participate in political activity. In response, the board chair told me and the public that no policies were violated. They were innocent of any wrongdoing. There is nothing inappropriate or unethical about this communication. The county attorney's office informed me that, much to their disappointment, in their opinion, campaign finance laws only apply to, quote, candidates. And since none of the legislators that are mentioned in here that were attacked in this letter were, quote, candidates involved in the middle of a campaign, none of the campaign finance laws applied. So while the bill before you, I feel, is a good start, there are a couple of loopholes that I wanted to touch upon. First, it appears that a district may be able to continue this practice of attacking legislators in general, not just on a particular proposal, but maybe just in a general broad sense. And somehow I believe this needs to be addressed in this proposal. Second, it appears that since many of the prohibitions here apply only to employees, as I read it, that means elected officials and volunteers will be allowed to continue to use district resources or have access to district information that the public either has no access to or may have to pay in order to get access to. So it needs to be made clear that this use of school resources here has to apply not only to employees, but also to elected officials or volunteers that they allow to use their facilities. Third, and finally here, there's no penalty for violating this proposal. When a violation occurs, what I feel will happen is the board will simply state that this is a personnel matter, and therefore any action on any complaint is protected by data practices laws. So in other words, in my personal opinion, nothing will happen if a violation occurs. I think, in my opinion, the violation needs to be categorized as either a misdemeanor or there be some process where a violation could be sent to the Office of Administrative Hearings. You can't allow the board to police themselves or their staff. It simply doesn't work, and I've gone through the process to prove that. I believe an outside review is needed if a complaint is to be made. And I want to make it clear also, while this particular communication here was against one political party, my feelings are the same regardless of what political party we're talking about. Public resources are supposed to be used for educating my children in school, in the classroom. If a group wants to send out partisan material, they can do it on their own time using their own resources. Or they can buy and pay whatever the cost is to use resources from the school district. If they want to buy an email list, then they should be in the same position as anybody else and follow the rules that I, as a private citizen, would have to follow. Madam Chair, thank you very much. I'll stand for any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you very much.
Open some other areas of consideration. Thank you very much for that. Jan Allswiger.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jan Allswiger, Education Minnesota. And as AMSD is hopeful that Senator Thompson will take care of their concerns, I'm hopeful that he will take care of our concerns as well. I think that the board member from Lakeville gave us some ideas about good policy. And there were some problems, evidently, in Lakeville, at least perceived by the school board. And the school board used their local control to make some changes in their policy. And it's working well. This, though, is a state mandate about how a policy must look like. If you look at the Lakeville policy, it would have to change drastically. That school board policy would not be allowed with this bill because this bill makes significant changes with the long list, the 1 through 5, and the other language in the bill. If a school board sees some inappropriate behavior, if a teacher is emailing at an inappropriate time, we would encourage the school board or the administrator to take the appropriate action. You have an email that was passed out from a teacher in the morning. That teacher may have prep time at that time. That teacher may work half days, might come in the afternoon. We don't know. Teachers have a lunch time, which is their own personal time. We're concerned that this language encompasses absolutely everything. If you look at line 1.14, advocate for any political issue. Any political issue. And the language that says advocate for the passage or defeat of something at the Minnesota legislature, you just heard a bill on prone restraint. As a teacher working in a school building, don't you want to hear from them as the professional teacher? Or do you have to wait to hear from them when they go home after they've eaten dinner at 7 p.m. and write a letter, an email from their home email address and use their home computer? I would think it's appropriate if you are passing or considering passing a law related to their professional work that you would want to get that information. And I must say, I'm not sure if everybody is aware, that the Department of Administration has put out an opinion that school employee addresses are public data. Listen to that. Public data. What we have found, Republican candidates have purchased those email addresses, and in one case, in October, before an election, sent all the teachers a survey, what do you think about these legislative issues? So if individuals from outside, whether they be curriculum companies, whether they be elected leaders or candidates for an office, can buy the email addresses and send emails in October before an election, why should it be that it's only one-way communication? Why can't there be communication both ways? I would just summarize by saying there is a process that's working in Lakeville because they have a school board policy that was developed by the local school board. This is a mandate that is so broad and so strict that many community events that you normally see would not be able to take place. Lakeville would have to change their current school board policy. So we would ask you to let the local school boards make their own decisions and adopt their policies according to what they feel fits their community. Thank you.
Thank you. And I think we've got one more. We'll close up with that. And thank you for your patience. We've gotten out here at 4:30 for a few times, so you're stretching it again tonight.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief because I know time is of essence. My name is Gary Amoroso. I serve as Executive Director of the Minnesota Association of School Administrators. And I want to thank Senator Bonhoff and Senator Thompson. Our main issue was one that's already been put on the table. Our members greatly appreciate the relationships that they've had and will have and continue to develop with our legislators. And we want to make sure that there is nothing that would prohibit us from having conversations open and honest with our legislators if we're asked about a specific bill or a policy. We do believe that as superintendents and other district office administrators that we can provide valuable information and at times provide our opinions, which we also think are valuable, and appreciate the fact that Senator Thompson is going to be willing to have some conversations regarding that piece. I also do want to mention that as a former superintendent of the Lakeville Area Public Schools for 10 years, policy A100 did serve us well. It provided clear expectations for the employees as well as, for our board in what we could or could not do. And it was something that I think was a good step on behalf of our board. And it did, as I mentioned, help the employees have a clear understanding of what was acceptable and what was not acceptable. So with that, again, I know the hour is late, so I thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Any questions, witness?
Madam Chair, I did have a quick question for Mr. Amoroso. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Amoroso. Do you see a possibility for you in your new role to send out a bulletin to all superintendents sharing what the success you had with Lakeville and recommending they consider adopting a similar policy?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Bonhoff. One of the significant successes, I think, of the Lakeville policy is that it truly was developed in Lakeville, and I would have no problem making reference to that policy with other superintendents and saying, here was something that was done because of the situations that were existing. But I also do think people need to have an opportunity to take a framework and then say, are there things happening within our system that need to be specifically addressed? But I felt and do feel that we had a strong policy. It was very clear. People understood the expectations and would have no problem sharing that with superintendents around the state.
Thank you.
Thank you. If there's no further discussion,
thank you.
This bill will be laid on the table. That's Senate File 577 for possible future consideration.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, appreciate your attention.
Thank you. And the meeting is adjourned. Oh. Thank you.